Good evening, honorable members and colleagues, stakeholders, good evening.
Good evening, Chairperson.
Good evening, Tati. Did you find the spot?
Yeah, no, I'm gonna park in the garage. At the garage in town, yeah, I'll be fine.
Okay. At least it's a public place, it's safer.
Yeah, it's safe. Thank you.
Okay, can we, will we be able to start with the minutes? Just select the agenda, please, Lubabalo. Do we have the quorum?
Yes, Chairperson, we do.
Okay. Let me officially declare the meeting open and welcome everybody who is on the platform, especially the members I know and the colleagues who are working behind the scenes, the support staff. You have been in meetings, back-to-back meetings since morning, and you have to start with this important meeting where you're going to deal with figures and take decisions. So I'm just hoping that you still have a reserve level of concentration somewhere in your body where you will be able to concentrate. We are going to have National Treasury to present both the special appropriation bill and the adjustment appropriation bill B23 and B24. So we only have one. So if members can please bear with us and take out that energy and concentrate. Thank you very much. Do we have apologies, Lubabalo or Esther? From your side, do you receive any apology?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good evening, honorable members and colleagues. Chairperson, we only have an apology from Honorable Dudoy. He will join the meeting a little bit later, because his flight took off in Warp Tambo coming to Cape Town at 17 hours. So as soon as he has landed this side, he will join the meeting. Thank you,
sir. Okay, hopefully it's not delayed so that he can still find us on the platform. So Esther, you didn't receive any apology. So we only have the apology from Honorable Detroit.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. We're not
sorry, and Yolanda also, I think she apologized to your office, the researcher.
Oh, okay, yeah. She also, yeah, I just forgot to present it to the meeting, the researcher. Yolanda is not in the meeting today or now because she had other prior commitments. And I released her. I allowed her to, or accepted her apology. So can we get the minutes of the 22nd of November? Let's start with the minutes. Okay, let's move. Let's go, honorable members. Check your names and surname if they are correctly. I'm skeptical of keeping my video on because of what happened yesterday. And even today, during plenary, the network was very, very frustrating. It was very bad. Okay, let's move to the next page. Page 4. This is the last page. Can I get a mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 22nd? You'll help me, Secretariat, with the identification of members who have raised their hands. Or members can just give me shouts.
Nita, move, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nita. Move for the adoption of the minutes. Seconder? Can I get a seconder? Honorable members, am I audible?
I'll think of Jefferson.
Thank you, Honorable Okam. Thank you. Let's go to the next item. And the next item is the presentation, the briefing by a National Treasury. National Treasury will give you 40 minutes you will for presentation on both bills, because we understand that the other one is shorter, but if you need more time, you can indicate. You will make a presentation on both bills, and then we will deliberate after the presentation. Who is leading the team? Is it Wendy?
Good evening, Chairperson and honorable members. It's Marmpo. Yes, I will be leading the team, Chair. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Mamudise.
Thank you, Chair. So I'll be leading. Nonkumelelo will do the first part of the presentation, and then we'll get the ALM team to do the rest of the presentation. So,
okay, over to you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mampo. Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Thank you so much, and good evening, Chair and honorable members. So I will be taking you through the first part of our presentation this evening on the Adjustment Appropriations Bill. Can go to the next slide, Mampo. Okay, so in terms of the outline, Chair, we're going to do, as usual, firstly take you through some of the background information that actually results us in presenting the bill to the committee, so in terms of the parliamentary process that must be followed, and then we're going to get into the detail of the specific adjustments that are included in the 2022-23 Adjustments Appropriations Bill, specifically focusing on all the different adjustments that are provided for in the Public Finance Management Act, in the Treasury Regulations, as well as in the next slide. Yes, that's fine, Mampo. So in terms of the introduction here, the Section 31 of the Public Finance Management Act requires the Minister of Finance to table an adjustment budget in the National Assembly as and when it is necessary. Generally, if we have one adjustment budget in a financial year, it will then be tabled in October. And then the different types of adjustments that the adjustment budget may provide for, and these include unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, as well as any expenditure in terms of Section 16, rollovers, the shifting of funds between votes, and et cetera. I won't spend too much time here because, Chair, I do go into the details of each of these adjustments throughout the presentation. So you can go to the next slide. So in terms of the adjustment appropriation bill itself, the bill provides for increases as well as decreases to allocations that are set out in the main appropriation act, which was tabled with the budget in February this year. So it will also include any shifts in anticipated economic classification of the spending. And then alongside the adjustments appropriation bill, we also have the division of revenue amendment bill, which provides for adjustments to allocations specifically to provinces that are and as well as municipalities. And then an explanatory memorandum to the adjustment appropriation bill is the adjusted estimate of national expenditure, which is a publication that we table alongside the media policy statement. And this particular publication explains changes in detail at national level together with any other in-year performance as well as expenditure. So it gives the status of spending and performance as at the end of the first 6 months of the financial year. And then also the shift of allocated expenditure and other adjustments are subject to the Public Finance Management Act as well as its regulations. And of course, Section 5 of the Appropriation Act of 2022, which we'll also go into detail on later on. Effect changes due to the in-year oversight and management of public finance. Next slide. Okay. So now if we go into the specific parliamentary process that is guiding the adjustments budget process. So firstly, we look at the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Amendment Act of 2018, which requires, in terms of Section 12.2, that an adjustment appropriation bill must be tabled with a national adjustment budget. And then Section 12.15 provides that in the event that we revise the fiscal framework, an adjustment appropriation bill must be referred to the Committee on Appropriations of the National Assembly only after the Division of Revenue Amendment Adjustment Appropriation Bill until the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill is passed by Parliament. And then in terms of Section 12.16, which provides for the standing rules, it notes that the standing rules must provide for the Committee on Appropriations to report any comments and amendments on the Adjustments Appropriation Bill, and then for other committees as well to consult with the Committee on Appropriations on amendments to transfer payments, recurrent and capital expenditure of a vote or as well as of a program with, that adopted by the House. And if we look at sections also still in the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. If you go to the next slide, Mampo. Yes, so C and D, that the Committee on Appropriations can mediate between committees providing conflicting comments on appropriation bill. And then in D, it provides that the Committee on Appropriations can recommend to the House that proposed amendments by other committees be rejected if it feels that those amendments are inconsistent with the fiscal framework that adopted Division of Revenue Bill or not adequately motivated for intent of this section. And then if we look at Section 17, 18 and 19, basically 17 provides that onto any proposed amendments to the Adjustment Appropriation Bill. And then Section 18 then notes that the Committee on Appropriations must ensure that it complies with Section 10 of this, any of the proposed amendments. And it requires in Section 19 for the Committee on Appropriations to report to the relevant House within 30 days after the National Adjustment Budget is tabled. So this is the background process in terms of the parliamentary process. And basically, to finance must table a revised fiscal framework with the national adjustments budget, if the adjustment budget actually effects changes to the fiscal framework. So where there's a change in the fiscal framework, there must be an accompanying national adjustment budget to effect those changes. And then again, Chair, the Minister must table the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill also with the revised fiscal framework if the adjustment budget does have implications for the Division of Revenue Act, which was tabled in February together with the main budget. And then, Chair, in the event of a revised fiscal framework, an adjustment appropriation bill must then be referred to the Committee on Appropriations only after the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill is passed in Parliament, as I have already noted. And then finally, any amendments to allocations for any of the votes in the adjustment appropriation bill would imply that where the committee might propose that certain votes must be given additional funding, that money would then have to be funded using existing baseline. So that would by implication mean that we would then have to decrease the funding that is allocated to another vote. You can go to the next slide, Mampo. So when we now look at the process of amendments to an appropriation bill, so in the event that the Committee on Appropriation would want to propose amendments, it's very important that it also provides very clearly what are the reasons for such a proposed amendment, and it must also consider how that amendment takes into account the broad strategic priorities and allocations of that relevant budget. And we also have to be mindful of what the implications of each of the proposed amendments are for an affected vote. And as well as in terms of the requirements, when the committee does propose amendments, is also clearly set out in terms of what it is on our service delivery as well. So this is just a high-level summary to guide us in terms of the process that that is followed when there are amendments that are proposed to the adjustment appropriation bill or to the appropriation bill. You can go to the next slide, Ma'am Paul. Okay, so Chair, now I'm going to go into the specific adjustments that are included in the adjustment appropriation bill for the 2022-23 financial year. So in total, Chair, there is 30 billion appropriation bill, which we're going to get a presentation on or just immediately after my presentation from, but specifically now in the adjustments appropriation bill, we look at the national departments, we've got adjustments, the net adjustments amount to about billion, and the majority of the adjustments are actually in expenditure as well as in relation to their service cost. So I will be taking you through each of these adjustments in the next few slides. So you can go to the next slide. So the next slide is basically breaking down the total adjustments in terms of economic classification. So how much of it is going towards and also just in terms of expenditure, is that expenditure which we could not anticipate at the time of the budget in February. So therefore, we have to provide for it in the adjustment budget, and it's provided for in Treasury Regulation 6. And then 6.6.1 actually specifies that the following may not be regarded as unforeseen and unavoidable. And this is a very important criteria that we consider when we do review from the National Treasury perspective these requests that we get. So if spending was known at the time of the budget in February, we cannot say that it's unforeseen and unavoidable, because we could foresee the expenditure because we knew about it at the time of the budget. And also, if the spending increase is as a result of either tariff adjustments or price increases, we also do not regard that as unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, as well as spending to extend existing services or create new services. Because when you are extending a service, there's already a service that exists, so we cannot say that was unforeseen because we could foresee the service already exists. So if we look at this type of adjustment change, there's about 6.4 billion actually in total that was allocated for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. And mainly all these adjustments related to unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure were in relation to the flooding that happened in a few provinces in April this year. So most of the funding is actually allocated for that purpose, which is why, Chair, you would see that there's an allocation of about 3.6 billion that's going to COPTA. And that allocation is for the Municipal Disaster Recovery Grant, specifically for the reconstruction and rehabilitation of the municipal infrastructure that was damaged by floods in KZN, Western Cape, as well as Eastern Cape. And then about 247.6 million of that is to replenish the municipal disaster response grant. And then about 97 million is for the provincial disaster response grant. And then another substantial allocation is to the Department of Transport, which is Vote 40. And they have about 1 billion that is allocated for the provincial road maintenance grant, but specifically the disaster relief component. And then other funding there is also allocated to the South African National Roads Agency, specifically for the damage to toll roads from the flood in KZN. Then maybe, Chair and Honourable Members, just to highlight, the allocation to Parliament, Vote 2, is the one that I would say is non-disaster related in regards to the flooding itself, although it's also a form of disaster. So this one was actually allocated to rehabilitate the parliamentary building that was damaged by fire early this year, as well as additional accommodation for Parliament members. Because that we could not foresee, it therefore is unforeseen, unavoidable as well. And then there's also about 48.5 million that's also allocated to the provincial equitable share, which is specifically to the Provincial Department of Social Development for the continued care and protection of flood victims who were placed in shelters in KwaZulu-Natal. And then another form of adjustments that we have sometimes in the budget speech, the minister does make pronouncements on certain allocations that are being made, but where there are certain conditions that need to be met first before we can actually allocate the funding. And an example of this is this 500 million that is being allocated to the Department of Home Affairs. It was pronounced in the 2022 budget speech, and it's specifically for the Presidential Employment Initiative, in particular the Home Affairs Digitization Program. So it's the only adjustment in this category. And then the next adjustment is a rollovers. Rollovers, we generally, departments are generally required to submit their request for rollovers at the end of April of every year. And rollovers are basically unspent funds from the previous financial year, which had been contracted by the end of the financial year, but could not be spent for certain reasons which are legitimate and beyond the control of the department. It is provided for in terms of Treasury Regulation 6.4, which also restricts rollovers. Not everything. Just because the department has not spent its money, it does not mean that it can automatically be rolled over. So there's very strict criteria for rollovers as well in terms of what can be rolled over. For example, in Treasury Regulation 6.4 clearly states that we do not roll over money for compensation of employees. And also, if you want to roll over money for goods and services, there's a maximum of 5%. So you cannot roll over more than 5% of your goods and services budget from the previous year. And then it also stipulates that if you want to roll over funding that was allocated for transfers and subsidies, you may not roll it over for any other purpose than what the funds were originally provided for. And then in regards to payments for capital assets, which is where, for example, allocations for infrastructure are categorized, those type of funding, it may not be rolled over to finalize, it can only be rolled over to finalize projects that were already in progress in that financial year. So in total, in the 2022 adjustment budget, we've got rollovers of about 990.5 million. The biggest rollovers are to the Departments of Agriculture, Communications and Digital Technologies, as well as to Statistics South Africa. In this slide here, we do for each one give a little bit more detail as to what the funds were rolled over for. For example, in the case of Fed SA, it was to provide for the remuneration of the census field staff. As we know, the census was done towards the end of the financial year, and as a result, some of the activities related to that had to continue beyond the previous financial year. Hence, there's an allocation that's made towards this essay. And then the one to the Department of Agriculture is for the payment of subsistence producers that are selected in phase two of the Presidential Employment Initiative. But Chair and Honourable Members, the detail for each of the rollovers is included on this slide, which I'm sure the members have got a presentation that was shared with them. Next slide. And then the next type of adjustment, Chair, is the shifting of funds between votes. Sometimes during the adjustment budget, we also do provide for instances where one department may need to shift funds to another department for a specific purpose. So just to give an example, in this particular case, the biggest shifts were actually from the Department of Social Development. So Social Development shifted about 3.7 billion, and the bulk of that actually went to the Department of Public Enterprises, and it was specifically for Transnet to repair the flood damage by infrastructure. So because Transnet gets its transfer from the Department of Public Enterprises, that's why those funds are allocated as part of that vote. And then another portion of that also went to the Department of Defense to cover a budget shortfall due to the extended deployment of the SANDF as part of the Operation Vigela in Mozambique. And then another shift was between the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure as well as the Department of Transport. So the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure shifted about 389 million to transport, and this was to the Provincial Roads Maintenance Grant to enable the construction of 24 bridges as part of the Welisizwe the rural bridges program. So when it comes to shifting between a vote chair, the net effect of that will always be zero, because we basically are deducting, reducing the baseline of one vote, and that money gets allocated to another vote. So that's why the net effect will always be zero. And then if we go to the next adjustment would then be self-financing. So self-financing is providing specifically for those instances where you've got departments like your Home Affairs, who as part of the execution of their normal operations would then also be generating income. For example, in the case of Home Affairs, if you have to go and take out an ID or request a passport, you do pay for that service. So in that sense, Home Affairs does generate revenue from that service. So there are those departments in that regard, who as part of the adjustment budget process then apply to the National Treasury to have some of that revenue retained by them, because in terms of the Treasury regulations of the PFMA, departments are not allowed to retain revenue. All of it must be transferred to the National Revenue Fund. So if they would like to retain the revenue, then they have to apply to the National Treasury as part of the adjustment budget process. And in order to enable this department to be able to reinvest that revenue into those operations that are even leading to the generation of that income, for example, in the case of Home Affairs, to reinvest into the systems and so forth that do generate the passwords and the IDs, they do request to retain some of that money, and which is why There's about 798 million that was approved for self-financing to Home Affairs. And then in the case of the Department of Defense as well, they do get some reimbursement from the United Nations towards peace support operations. So in order for them to keep on being able to do that function, they do request as part of the of financing to retain a portion of that money that they get from the United Nations. That's why in this case, million. So in total, the self-financing is 1.6 billion for 2022-23. And then the next adjustment, so this one we're talking not about increasing baselines, but about decreasing baselines. So there are those instances where certain departments would can see already in 6 months into the year that certain funds will not be spent by the end of the financial year. So therefore, as part of the adjustment budget, they then declare that funding back to the National Treasury. And generally, there's good grounds or reasons why a department would do that. For example, in the case of social development, they actually declared or returned as part of the adjustment budget about 1.8 billion. And this 1.8 billion is basically derived from savings in the social relief of this grant. So in terms of what we had budgeted for in the criteria to make sure that only the neediest actually qualify from the grant, then we realized that so we need less than what was allocated in the budget in order to be able to pay those who qualify for this grant, which is why then about 1.8 billion was declared as part of that budget. And then in other cases as well, for example, in the police, there are projects which they know they've been delayed as part of the procurement process. They know that they're not going to be able to finalize the procurement of those projects in the current financial year, and that's why they declare some of this money. And honorable members, I must say, sometimes we do encourage this because instead of departments, you know, retaining this money to underspend it at the end of the financial year, it can also be reallocated to get unspent funds. It's not necessarily a bad thing, except there are those instances where it's because of underspend. Further in section 43 of the PFMA. So it gives specific guidance. For example, in 6.3.1A, it notes that compensation of employees and transfers and subsidies to other institutions, but excluding transfers to other levels of government for purposes of paying levies and taxes imposed by legislation, may not be increased without the approval of the relevant treasury. So a department cannot increase its transfers and subsidies budget without getting approval from us. So again, in Treasury Regulation 6.3, it specifically states to departments exactly under what circumstances they would need to get our approval. And then if you go to the next slide, so the last section that's also very key when we consider environments and shifts would be Section 5 of the Appropriation Act 2022. And in Section 5 of the Appropriation Act, it basically provides for those instances that even though something may be prohibited, let's say in terms of Section 43 of the PFMA, it may, in the interest of service delivery, Section 5 can, under certain circumstances, empower the Minister of Finance to grant approval to departments to make certain shifts in funding. Although also in Section 5, it also provides for those instances where the Minister of Finance is not authorized to approve, but only Parliament can do that. So, Chair and Honourable Members, this is just a background, again, to remind us of the violence and shift process. I think you can skip the slide, Mampo, in the interest of time. And then, Chair, now we are giving some of the specific violence and shifts, examples of the specific violence and shifts that require approval from Parliament. All those that we have circled in red are the ones that only Parliament can approve. For example, in this instance, the National Treasury would like to shift about 13 million, for example, from the Development Bank of South Africa, and that money is being shifted to the Financial Intermediary Fund. And just to explain, it's not that they are cutting money for the DBSA. Actually, this money that is being shifted here was money that was, there's a saving in terms of what was meant to be transferred to the DBSA, specifically for the operational cost of the infrastructure fund. So that's why, because what the cost of the operations are less than what we had anticipated at the time of the budget, that's why this budget is being reduced. It's not to say that the National Treasury is cutting any funding that is supposed to go to the DBSA. And then there are those instances where, Chair, if a department wants to move more than 8% of the total program budget, National Treasury cannot approve those violations and only Parliament can, which is why in this particular instance, the total violations from Program 5 in the National Treasury actually amount to 15.7% of the program budget, which is why only Parliament can approve. And then if you go to the next one, so Chair and Honourable Members, I'm not going to go through each of the violations, but I just want to give examples to give effect to that to those legislative provisions that I highlighted earlier on. Another violation that only Parliament can approve is where a department is reducing the budget for compensation of employees and is going for other purposes. So if a department would like to increase the budget of compensation of employees, the Minister of Finance can approve that. But if it's reducing it, only Parliament can approve it, which is the case in the case of higher education and training. Next vote, health. There's a total of about 1.1 million that is being shifted from business advisory services and is specifically to provide for the transfer payment to the South African Medical Research Council for the Global Adult Tobacco Survey. So this one would then require the approval of Parliament. The next one. And Chair, just to note, not all departments necessarily have violations that require Parliament's approval. Some departments don't have violations that require National Treasury or Parliament approval, and others have got requirements that require only Parliament approval, whilst others have got requirements that require both Parliament as well as National Treasury approval, which is why we try and distinguish using the footnotes that you see on the slide. Basically, social development, they are moving about 538 million from the lower than anticipated uptake in social grants, as I've explained earlier, and they are moving that to write off the social assistance debt. And then if we go to the next vote, which is the IPID, they've got several violations, but we can skip that slide, Mampo, is fine. And then just to look at employment and labor, for example, once again, they're also decreasing compensation of employees. So that would then require Parliament's approval. And they're also moving more than 8% of their budget for Program 2, which is why it requires Parliament's approval. And then in the case of the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries, they've also got several violations that require approval from Parliament, but none of them are more than 8%. And then in the case of the Department of Science and Innovation, they've got quite a number of violations that require Parliament's approval, moving money from different items such as your research and development infrastructure. And then in the case of trade and industry, which I think is the last one, as you can see, Honourable Members, there's also quite a few shifts that are being implemented in this vote. I think that would be the end of this part of the presentation. I can now hand over to my colleagues to take us through the special appropriation bill. Thank you.
Okay, who comes next, Mampo?
Tulu fellow chair, I'm just slicing the presentation for them. I hope the colleagues can just go through the presentations quickly because of time. Tulu, please go ahead.
Okay, no, thanks, Mampo. Can you please just get a second just to switch my camera on? Okay. Okay, so this is the presentation. Okay, so as we all know that the minister will be introducing the special appropriation bill proposing the following additional allocations for the 2023 fiscal year. 3.4 will go towards the NEL for the implementation of its turnaround plan, and then 24 billion will go towards SANRAL for the repayment of its maturing debt and related obligations. 2.9 towards Transnet for the acceleration in the repair for the acceleration of the repair and maintenance of locomotives. The payment towards these entities will only be disbursed in an event that the conditions set by the Minister of Finance are met. Next slide, Mampo, please. So for Denel. So Denel, for its turnaround plan, has indicated that it requires 5.2 billion. Of this money, 3.4 will be through the recapitalization, 1.8 will be through the sale of Denel's non-core assets. So Denel will utilize these funds to settle its current and legacy obligations, including restructuring costs, which will see the stabilization and the entity being sustained in order to be able to meet its anticipated growth opportunities as indicated. So this funding will be subject to various conditions. Next slide, please, Anton. Okay. So these are the conditions. So we have preconditions is that the shareholder, which is DPE, must confirm the support for the turnaround plan, the disposal of all the identified non-core assets, and then the submission of a strategic equity partnership strategy. The surplus funds that will come through from the Section 189 implementation should be used to pay off any remaining government debt. The funds for the legacy obligations will be ring-fenced, and then the Denel Monitoring Committee should be re-established. And these funds will only be disbursed, as mentioned before, only following the adherence of the preconditions. There will also be post-conditions which would be attached, that is, DPE will need to make sure that it finalizes the memorandum of cooperation with the BOD. This should be done within a period of 6 months following receipt of the recapitalization funds. And then DPE would need to withdraw a specified...
Team Treasury, don't rush too much. Ne? I did indicate that you're within 40 minutes, but if you feel you are under pressure, you must indicate. I feel you are rushing too much.
Oh, apologies, Chair. Because,
yeah,
okay.
Members must get more information. Maybe that will also help in reducing the question.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah. So I'll slow down. I'll start with post-conditions. That is, what National Treasury anticipates is that DP must finalize the memorandum of cooperation with the DOD within 6 months of receipt of the recapitalization funds. This will ensure that there is alignment between the two departments, especially when it comes to the requirements of the defense force. And then it's that DPE would need to withdraw certain government guarantees. These are guarantees that have remained underutilized or not utilized at all. So this would also help reduce the contingent liabilities for government. And then Danielle is to continue submitting quarterly performance report to both DPE and National Treasury. This is to ensure that the Executive Authority as well as National Treasury can monitor the implementation of the turnaround plan and make sure that should there be any gaps that come out, that Danielle is able to enforce mitigating strategies to bring the plan back in line with the indicated timelines. So for the period of the implementation of the turnaround plan, so no bonuses should be paid through to the executive of Danielle. This is to make sure that the recapitalization funds don't go towards bonuses, especially taking into account the financial position of Danielle at the moment. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to Nolwazi to present Transnet.
Good evening, colleagues and honorable members. So I'll be taking you through the Transnet slide. So Transnet has been allocated 2.9 billion to assist in the repair and maintenance of its locomotives. So this will assist in addressing some of the operational challenges faced by Transnet, specifically relating to the shortage of locomotives. So we have attached conditions to the funding that will enable us to have greater oversight over the company. So as part of the conditions, we will be conducting an independent review of all the freight and port operations. So this will give us a better understanding of the challenges faced by the company and also proposed solutions. We have also introduced monthly reporting to assess both the operational and financial performance of Transnet on a more frequent basis. And lastly, the PSMA Section 54 applications will now be approved by both the Ministers of Finance and Public Enterprises. So, honourable members, these conditions will be reviewed on an annual basis. Thank you. I'll hand over to Ulrika now to take us through the SANRAL slide.
Okay. Good evening, honourable members and honourable chair. So, for SANRAL, government is proposing a 22.7 billion rand allocation to SANRAL. To pay for its maturing obligations in the next two financial years. This money is only ring-fenced for that and cannot be used for any other purpose. SANRAL, in terms of Section 66 and Section 70 of the PFMA, its existing borrowing limits and guarantees will not be automatic, and they have to, it will run down in line with these allocations, and they would have to come back to the Minister of Finance for approval for any new borrowings. Next slide, please. These allocations are proposed to be split into two tranches. The first will be upon promulgation of the Special Appropriation Act. That would then allow SANRAL to meet its going concern obligations, and the balance of the allocations will be transferred on the back of a series of conditions. The first is that the Department of Transport needs to develop a road funding policy for government. I mean, this allocation to SANRAL fundamentally implies that we are subsidizing toll roads and outside of a policy framework to ensure that we have equity in allocation of resources. So that's an important one that the Department of Transport needs to do. In the next few months, we will also be conducting independent reviews of SANRAL's procurement processes and their supply chain management policy, an independent review of the performance of the board that would then also use those recommendations in the appointment of a new SANRAL board. The SANRAL board's term has come to an end, and the Minister of Transport has extended that, and this review should help the Minister with the appointment of the new board. One of the core requirements around this allocation is that national government and the provincial government signs an agreement around the financing and the sustainability of phase one of the Gauteng Improvement Program. There are specific requirements that the province will have to deal with in relation to phase two and phase three of the program, and given that this is on their road reserve. This includes the province assisting in the financing of SANRAL's current obligations in relation to GFIP, and ensuring that this is that the road network is sustainably maintained. Any of these conditions that are not met by the end of the financial year would be to the credit of the National Revenue Fund. So even if the Department of Transport then transfers these funds and something happens, that means that we are not able to, say, for example, complete the finalization of the board review, the money will then revert back into the National Revenue Fund. Given the provisions that we have in the PFMA around oversight, we will then use the provisions that we have in sections, I think it's 39 and section 51 of the PFMA, to ensure that these conditions, or to track progress on these conditions between now and 31 March 2023. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you so much. This is the two presentations from the National Treasury. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Treasury, for the presentation. I think it has helped us in terms of the questions that we had, and also the dissatisfactions that we had as we were engaging with the Division of Revenue Bills. But having said that, I will now request members to raise their hands if they do want to talk. Honorable members. Honorable Ryder. Honorable Ryder.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, can I go ahead?
Honorable Ryder.
Okay, it's Honorable Ryder, Honorable Mulesani, and Njatu. You can go on, Honorable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Treasury, for the presentations. And yes, you did speed through them. So I'm going to take you back, Ms. Kadebe, in your first to your section first. There were two issues that you raised about the Department of Social Development that I'd like you to spend a little bit more time on. The first is that there was a shift, you said, from DSD to Defense, and I think it was Home Affairs. Now, if you can just tell us what where that money came from, what hasn't been done. I think you motivated quite well where it's going to, but you were not as clear to say where within the Department of Social Development that saving happened, or that underspending, or that reprioritization was happening. Then you spoke as well a little later about the internal environment, and it spoke about the load take-up of the 350 grant. And you said that was going to be moved elsewhere. If you can just perhaps repeat what you said on that piece and spell it out, make it clear for us, because there, that one, you really sped through. It was almost as if you were hoping not to talk about it. So just unpack those two parts. Then, of course, we get to the bailouts. And the bailouts is the area that I probably have most focus on. The conditions are unnoted. However, I'm not sure what the penalties will be for non-compliance with all of the ongoing ones. So understandably, you did say you're going to hold back on the disbursement, which is going to be great. That's fine until I've met them. You did say that the shareholder needs to approve the business plan, and I think that was all the turnaround plan, the recovery plan of Donnell. Will that go through a committee process, or will that just be for the executive to decide? It's one thing to have a real transparent process. It's something different to just have people in smoky rooms agreeing to the turnaround plan. And often it's the people that got us in the mess in the first place. With SANRAL, there was a comment. Sorry, was it Consnet or SANRAL? It was, yeah, Consnet. There's an issue that there was an amount recovered from the medical benefit fund. So that obviously, you know, I'm not sure if that's normal, that if there's been a saving or a surplus built up in a medical fund. I do know with pension funds, when such a thing happens, it gets dispersed to the members. Is it normal for that to go back to the shareholder or the employer? If you can tell me that. But two of my biggest questions come around the Sanral ETOL saga. I was chuckling a bit because you were talking about unavoidable and unforeseen. And I realize that this is a special appropriation, so it doesn't apply. But the crash of ETOLs was foreseen and predicted before it was even started. And here we find ourselves in a situation where we've been forced to pay a lot of money for a really bad project. And I mean, you know, anyone who drives around Gauteng specifically, you know, you're faced by these little palaces that have been built up all around Gauteng, these ETOL centers that were constructed, all in, you know, a smaller version of their big head office. And they've dotted them around for customers to walk in and give them all this money that they were hoping to collect, which was never going to happen. So it's a bad project, and I think that you know, it's finally been acknowledged, and it's trying to be unwound. The scary thing is that $9 billion is required immediately to retain the going concern status. So, and I mean, again, it comes to a point of asking why took so long to find a solution. And in fact, I don't believe we have found a solution, because the split between Gauteng and the National Treasury is almost unaffordable. I mean, I don't know where Gauteng is going to get their 30% share of this debt that needs to be repaid. So has there really been a plan behind this, or is this just a last-minute patch to try and get us through so that we can really work out what's going to happen? Because I don't think Gauteng has got a funding model. When the Premier Lesufi spoke about it, he spoke about the fact that he was going to raise the money through consultation. Now, you know, if I could raise money through consultation, I'd be a lot more wealthy than I am now, because I consult a lot. But I don't get too much money for it. But I'm very concerned about this ETOLS money. That's a big chunk, 23.7 billion rand, and it's not even everything. So. You know, is it going to be enough is probably my best question. And what happens when Gauteng can't come up with their share of the money? My last question, Chair, relates to the ongoing spitting contest, I suppose we could call it, between public wage unions, the public sector unions, and government. And the fact that it looks like there's going to need to be a higher settlement. There was more posturing today or yesterday that was reported upon today. And you know, it's quite scary that we're going to find ourselves in a situation where additional funding is going to need to be sought. Are we going to have to find that out of the what we thought we were going to save from the windfall? Are we going to dip into that? Is that the proposal? You know, if there is any more money coming from, where will we find? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Raila. Very good questions. I think
it's 19 hours.
Your constituents might be, or are, not might, they are happy with the questions that you're raising, because these are the concerns that come from all angles. I really like your questions. And the next one is Ntate Molefane.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just need one clarity. Let me acknowledge the presentation. When the presenter was presenting the adjustment, the 2022 adjustment appropriation bill, under the unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure caused by disaster. Only Western Cape, KZN, and Eastern Cape are covered. My question is, why Free State is not included under this adjustment, since it has experienced the disaster in Jagersfontein? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Ntate Mletsane. Honorable Njatu.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good evening to all the members. Chairperson, I would need more clarity on the underspending on the police. My question, Chairperson, will be, what was the reason for underspending of the 31 million for the police? The department is struggling to revamp, equip and complete certain new police stations, including the one in Manguzi in KwaZulu-Natal. So, Chairperson, that is to get more clarity on that. And also further clarity, Chair, is the what is the reason for the underspending also in the social relief of distress grant when the unemployment and poverty remains high? And what is the exact criteria for people to apply for this grant? And maybe the committee may need to invite the Department of Social Development to look at this one, at this closely. Chairperson, those are the first two questions. The last question will be whether, or that is under special appropriations, whether government has set clear time frames and plans to ensure that issues affecting SOEs are complete, sorted, and start contributing towards growing the economy in various sectors. Chairperson, for now, those are the three questions for clarity. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Njatu. One needs also to appreciate the questions that you really are. You are representing your provinces and your constituencies in general. Any other hands? Dubabalo, is there any other hands? None,
Chairperson.
Thank you. Okay. I will start with the last presentation, and I will generalize my question in as far as the SOEs are concerned. What I would like to know is that generally as government, do you or were you given a clear set of plans with time frames so that when you allocate these monies to these SOEs, you satisfy yourself that there are plans and those plans, they have achievable indicators or achievable outcomes? I just want Treasury to make a commitment that you satisfied yourself with the SOEs. And I think you will understand why I'm so concerned in as far as SOEs are concerned. When we started in 2019, we were a very, very, very reluctant to agree to the bailout of SAA. Was it SAA or Eskom? I don't remember. It's between the two or both. whereby we even said that before we can approve, we want to see those conditions so that we can be able to also monitor ourselves and do our oversight to see if the monies were spent according to the conditions, they made the conditions. So now that you have this, I just want to know, because sometimes when we had the, we were doing the mid-year review, in terms of the performance, some departments, more especially, I can just give an example of human settlements, they have spent less, and when we engage the provincial department, when we engage them, we found out that they did not have plans, or there were no agreement, service level agreement between them and their agency. So that is a problem. And my first question, I think, is ESCOM, not the SAA, the one that I'm talking about. So just confirm if you are sure you're satisfied with the plan that they are going to use that money for what it's meant for. I think members have covered mostly issues that I wanted to speak to, more especially in terms of the crisis management. And also wanting to know that what measures are taken to ensure that the understanding of the 101 million rand of payment for financial assets is addressed by National Treasury. What was the reason for this 101 million rand under expenditure? So those are the few. I'm covered in terms of the question by Honorable Njatu on the social relief fund. The other question that I have is, what are these, the implications or the impact of this projected understanding or service delivery? As Treasury, maybe you understand better, you will help me in terms of the implications thereof. You have outlined correctly when you spoke about the under expenditure expenditure on unforeseeable incidents. We've spoken about that. We have a certain understanding in terms of those things, of those conditions. But then, I don't know, and it's a pity, I cannot change it. You're saying if there's a rollover, they need to make, you were talking about the revenue. You made an example with the Home Affairs, that if they want to keep that revenue that they have raised, they need to make an application to Treasury. I wish I could change that. That money, all the money must go to Treasury, and no department must be allowed to keep the revenue. The center must hold, so that you as Treasury, you can allocate and see where the need is most. So that in that case it could have happened. It could have helped a lot. But maybe I misunderstand the logic behind the legislation that allows that to happen. My last question is in relation to the shifting of funds. What is done by the National Treasury to ensure that the shifting of funds does not defeat service delivery purpose for programs where funds were initially allocated for? I think Mampo and the team, you don't hear me talking about this for the first time. You have heard me talking about it even when we talk to the AG and the performance. I raise it that there should be an impact. Sometimes after doing the audit for the department will be given a clean audit outcome, but then does the outcome or the spending of the money speak to the service delivery? That is something that we need to look at if we want to help, because at the end of the day, we allocate money for people to get services. I think I'll leave it at that. Some of the questions, when you talk, maybe you will cover me, because I also wanted to talk about the issue of the wage bill, but Honorable Ride has spoken about it. So I think maybe I will be covered. I will hand over to you, Mampo, and the team. Mampo, would you say?
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. I'm here. So, Chair?
I'm saying over to you. You can take over.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no other hand.
All right. Thank you so much, Chairperson. I think the first question where I'm going to spend enough time talking about would be the question on social development and the allocations there and the shifting of funds. So, you know, Chairperson and honorable members, as the Treasury, we are always tasked to do a very difficult job. We're basically tasked to make sure that funds go to people that deserve the funding. We need to make sure that we close the gaps for corruption, we close the gaps for theft, we close all the gaps that are possible. So when we introduced the 350 grant in 2020, we didn't have sufficient time to look at the criteria that we can put in order to make sure that there are no people who are benefiting from the grant and not supposed to benefit from the grant. So in 2020, we were under pressure. We implement the 350 grant. We implement the top up of the grant. Then in 2021, we basically continued the 350 grant. But then what we realized in 2021 is that we might be having both inclusion and exclusion errors. So when I say inclusion errors, I'm Chairperson and honorable members, it means having people who are receiving a grant who should not be receiving a grant. But also we had to look at who are the people who are supposed to be receiving this grant but are not receiving the grant. So in 2021, we started implementing some criteria to say, this is what you need for you to successfully get the grant. This is the incentive income, you should be unemployed. So those were the criteria that we then used. Then in 2022, we then contracted the bank just to make sure, Chair and honorable members, that people who have decided that they are going to open bank accounts, multiple bank accounts, and only apply to SASSA with the bank account that they know doesn't receive income, we can pick them up. So basically, the contract that we have with the banks is that we can, across the bank, see who is receiving income, how much is the income, and whether people are receiving multiple income. So that's the first thing, or that's the first criteria, honorable members, that we put in place to see
whether legitimately the people that are applying for this residency do not have income. Then the second criteria that we put in place was basically because the application process was that you apply once a year. So if you applied in January and you get a job in February and you are fortunate to get a job in February, you will receive the 350 grant until the end of the year. And by the time you get employment, you no longer qualify for the grant because you already have employment. So when we put those measures in place, then we realized that there were more people who were getting the grant who should not be getting the grant. But of course, we also made sure that the people who were not getting the grant but were supposed to get the grant, we put them in the system. Another measure, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that we will be considering and we're already considering is what we refer to as e-wallet, you know, the cell phone banking. Because there are people who are working, even if it's been informal work, they do get income, for example, gardeners and people who do some of that type of work, they get income through cell phone banking. And they still apply for the 350 grant. If you have a job, you don't qualify for the grant. So the understanding or whatever I would refer to as saving is the wrong word that we're using, because this is basically efficiency gain. We have put in place measures to make sure that people don't rob the state and benefit from the grant, but they don't deserve the grant. So by putting those measures in place, we managed to reduce the number of people that qualify for the grant. So it is cleaning up the system that has helped us considerably to make sure that there's efficiency in the system. So this is purely improving the system. And Honorable Members and Chairperson, I just want to assure you, this understanding of savings or efficiency gain does not take money away from the people that deserve the money. What it does is it takes money away from the people who are robbing the state. And that is what efficiency gain is all about, trying to make sure the people that do not deserve the money don't get the money, don't misuse the funds. So, Chair, I'm also going to look at the issue of the National Treasury, the underspending. This is basically a technical correction that we had to do because the land bank defaulted and we had to basically pay up the guaranteed debt because it was guaranteed debt. Therefore, we didn't need the 101 million in the manner in which it was appropriated, because this was appropriated to recapitalize the bank. But because we had to pay the guaranteed debt as part of the direct charges in the NRF, then it means that 101 became an understanding. But it's purely because the guaranteed debt defaulted and we had to pay it through a direct charge of the NRF. Then, Chair, I mean, when we look at self-financing, the criteria there is very stringent. There's two arguments to the self-financing. The first argument is that how do you then disperse the departments who have spent their money on something else and they now need to focus on service delivery. So for example, the Defence Force, when they take the troops to the DRC or they pay for the troops in the DRC, it means they're using other money that was allocated for something else to basically pay or augment for the troops that are in the DRC. Bringing the troops back, getting the money back, it means that they will then close the gap where they took the funding. So that is, we don't see it as a problem because basically this is not money, it's money that they budgeted for, but they're only receiving later. So if you look at the list of the departments that are getting self-financing, it's very limited, and it's mainly because when we do the assessment, we need to make sure that one, departments must be paid to the NRF. But if, for example, you look at a department like Correctional Services, as they make their own food, they make their own garden, they make their own equipment, they make their own furniture. If they can sell that furniture to the rest of government, then they can take that money, the proceeds of sale, and then fix some of the prisons that they have, fix the equipment that they have, fix some of the IT systems that they have. So it's another tool that we have in the system where we try to encourage some of these departments to think outside the box on how they can generate revenue and then use that revenue to fix some of the issues that they have that they might not be able to fix because of some of the funding constraints. Chairperson, let me give Ulrika first the opportunity to deal with ETOLs and some of the disaster spending, and then Nombumelano to deal with police, and then the ALM team to deal with some of the agencies. I'll come back with the wage settlement question. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Mambo.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm assisting the chairperson. Okay, we can proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, Honourable Ryder's question around SANRAL and is there a funding model? Yes, there is a funding model, Honourable Ryder. One of the things that we have to agree with the province is ensuring that there's kind of affordability without and compromising the integrity of the network. So the MOU will set out all of those arrangements around how the province is going to pay for this, and also set out any of the requirements or the conditions around what happens when the province doesn't pay for it. So that will be an agreement between national government and the province to deal with that. We don't have any preconceived ideas on what that needs to look like. On Honourable Molefane's questions around the disaster recovery and the disaster funding, a large chunk of the funding that we have in the system would be for the rehabilitation of infrastructure related to the flood damage. So this was the April and May floods. In relation to Yaksin, that happened a little bit later. So in the disaster management cycle, we first deal with relief and then we deal with recovery. The Yaksin disaster would be in the relief phase, so that is you provide immediate relief versus the rehabilitation that comes with dealing with the long term fixing and restoring of the infrastructure. So that's the difference between the spending that's the budget that we have right now. With the Yaksin disaster, we anticipate that this is not necessarily in the same way with the flood, where the liability would lie with government. So the rehabilitation and the recovery of infrastructure should be funded slightly differently. But the modalities around all of that is being worked out by the province. Since this was declared as a provincial disaster and classified as a provincial disaster, it is up to the province to decide on how they want to do that and then approach national government where assistance is needed. At the time of the budget, that has not happened, which is why we only have the funding for the floods and not necessarily to deal with any disasters that might have happened later in the year. And this would include any of the other kind of issues we've seen in relation to housing emergencies that popped up post the recovery. What the budget does provide for, or what the adjustments budget does provide us, is to top up the immediate relief grant. So the top up in the DCOG vote on the immediate provincial and the municipal disaster relief grant or disaster response grant, and on the provincial emergency housing grant, that does create some space for those transferring officers to deal with any disasters that may have happened subsequent to the April and May floods. Thanks.
Thank you very much,
Rika. Can I go in here?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair. I think Honorable Kruneval's question on the environment or the shifting of funds has been addressed by Mampo, so I hope that answer was satisfactory. Then I can just talk to the issue of the police, the 31 million, and maybe just to give context, Chair. So the police every year they receive an allocation that is earmarked by us for what we call the integrated for the implementation of the integrated criminal justice strategy. So this is the strategy that followed the old CJS 7-point plan. So as part of that process of allocating that funding, we do set conditions in terms of them reporting, but also in terms of them submitting plans on what the money is for. And in this, and we also have a condition in the allocation letter that says that should they determine during the course of the year that due to whatever reason they will not be able to fully exhaust the funds that have been allocated, then they need to return the funds during the adjustment budget. So it's in terms of that condition, firstly, that the department is returning the funding. And in terms of why are they returning the funding or what's the service delivery impact of that. So basically, the money that is allocated for the ICJS is specifically in the forensic services space of the department. And most of the software and equipment that is procured in that space is actually procured internationally. So flowing from some of the stock shortages from the COVID-19 pandemic and now with the Russia-Ukraine war, there's been a delivery delay with some of the items that are being procured in the forensic services space that are coming from internationally. So part of the reason why there was no spending was that, but also coupled with a few supply chain management delays in the department, but that were also as a result of those delays in procurement internationally. Now, just to explain also, Chair, what the funding specifically, which project. So one of them is the CODIS system. So it's for two specific projects that the funds allocated. So one is the CODIS system, and the other one is the semi-automated DNA processing system. Both systems are actually contributing or supporting the implementation of the Criminal Law Forensic Procedure and Amendment Act, which, as we know, is the DNA Act that authorizes the department to actually collect DNA samples from people that are in incarceration. So the CODIS system specifically is the one that allows the department to do comparison and searching, as well as to be able to see if the DNA of sample of a particular person is not linked to another crime, as an example. And similarly, with the semi-automated DNA processing system, is also specifically for one of the forensic laboratories in Eastern Cape. So both of them are quite critical for service delivery. They are not new projects necessarily. They are ongoing, but every now and then they need to do software updates and installation, which is what actually they were trying to procure in the current financial year. So those would be the two systems that are affected by this, but also what the impact on service delivery would be. And then maybe just also briefly the question on environments as well as the impact on service delivery, just to indicate, Honourable Chair, that as part the reason why the legislation is written in such a manner that allows us to approve the environments or allows Parliament to approve some of these environments is so that we can exercise the necessary due diligence to also question departments on the extent to which them shifting the funding is actually going to have an impact on service delivery. But like I also indicated during the presentation, there are those instances where you find, because of foreign exchange rate fluctuations, where the cost is now higher than what we had budgeted for, the department has to reprioritize funds internally in order to offset that excess expenditure. So it's not in all the cases that you find that due to bad financial management, the department now needs to move money. But there are those good reasons why sometimes the department may need to shift money between programs. But we do the due diligence, and those are the considerations that we also make before we approve. Because it's not automatic that when they submit environment request to us, we will approve it. We actually do ask them these questions. What's the impact that this is going to have on service delivery? And if we're not convinced by the case that the department is presenting, then there are instances where we actually don't grant approval for the environment. Thank you.
ALMT?
I didn't realize that I was on mute. Apologies. So I will be answering the questions on Danelle. The one on whether the business plan presented by Danelle to the shareholder will only be approved by the shareholder or taken through a committee. So the business plan will be only approved by the shareholder, but however, this is subsequent to Danelle doing the relevant consultations with the stakeholders, wherein Danelle may have capabilities that may be servicing the DOD or the Department of Science and Technology. So those consultations were done, but final approval lies with the shareholder. And then the one on the DMBT, or if it was a good idea for Danelle to access funds from the Medical Aid Benefit Trust. So I'd just like to point out that before Danelle could access these benefits, Danelle had to go through rigorous due diligence processes. This included the entity undertaking evaluation on the DMBT to determine the assets and liabilities in the fund. It also included the entity themselves engaging with the beneficiaries of this trust, wherein they would either accept or not accept the offer that was made. But this was done in such a way that it will ensure that the beneficiaries will still receive future benefits out of the fund. So in other words, you could say that they were compensated in order for Danelle to be able to access these funds. Another thing is that this transaction was taken through a court process, so it had to be approved by the court before Danelle could access these funds. So in this manner, it ensured that the beneficiaries mostly are covered and they are not compromised. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Mampo. Any further responses?
Yes, Chair. So the biggest, the one that Honorable Ryder asked was the question on the wage settlement. Chairperson, you know, the thing with budget is that you have to make trade-offs. So basically, it's the budget allocation security over the next 3 years in the MTEF. And of course, any wage settlement that is above what we can afford, which is what was implemented, means that the resources that we think could be allocated for the improvement of these services, especially health, education, and the security cluster, then we will have to reconsider some of the budget decisions that we have made. I think, Chairperson, what I want to clarify is that we don't have the funds. We don't have the funding. So Treasury or government is not sitting with funding that we think public services don't deserve such increases. What we had to do with this budget was to look at a balance between trying to deal with the baselines that have been eroded in the past and avoid a total collapse of services in government. So the manner in which we have done this was, one, we made sure that we don't have a debt crisis, and we are not in the position where we now need IMF and everyone to bail us out. We also trying to make sure that the debt servicing costs do not take much out of our resources. When you look at the numbers, the debt servicing costs are the second largest item of spending that we have over the MTF. It's education, learning and culture, then debt service, of course. It surpasses social grants, health, security. So the fact that we're paying so much in debt service, of course, meant that we have to reconsider the level of debt that we have. So with the revenue overruns, we then did the split where we said part of this needs to resolve the issue of debt and the significant rising or the fast rising in debt servicing costs. But then secondly, the part that we can deal with some of the pressures that we have in the system, how do we then balance it? And we had to look at how is the health sector, what has the recent reductions or consolidation done to the sector. We had to look at education. Is it fair that we retrench 3,000 teachers because we don't have budget? Is it fair that we let go of all the nurses and doctors that we employed during COVID? Just because COVID is not as significant or it doesn't have as much significant impact as it did before, it doesn't mean that the health sector is not under pressure. So we had to do a balancing act to look at how do we balance as the state the compensation of employees, taking into consideration that their spending power has been eroded because of the rising goods and services. So the cost of living is so high. But also, what then do you do with the services that are critical for our people? How do you balance this? And the manner in which we've done so, Chairperson, and honorable members, we think it is balanced and it takes into consideration the trade-offs, but also you're balancing dealing with the wages, but also dealing with the basic services that our people deserve. And that's how we thought about this budget. So if honorable writer, the union, the strike force and the much demand on the fiscal, then we would have to reconsider the split that we did in terms of looking at the services for the people. But also, Chairperson, what I want to say is that what we have done, it is not out of the ambits of the public service. We do have government does have the leeway to implement a wage offer, and this is in the Public Services Act. But we didn't do this in spitefully or, you know, with a spite intention. All we did was look at how do we balance the envelope that we have such that not one sector benefits, but the other sector doesn't benefit. So that's what we're trying to do. Hope this clarifies the question on the wage bill. Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you, Mampo. Thank you, Team Treasury. Can I check if members want to have the follow-up, Dennis Ryder?
Thank you very much, Chairman Mklangu. Thanks for the answers. Sorry, you'll see around the clock. I normally do because there's no power in the back, so we've got candles and things running. The answers, Chair, leave me feeling a little bit, unfulfilled. And I mean, so the one answer, and specifically the one that I want to pick on, and I'm not trying to be to pick on individuals, but just the answer, and the answer said that. Yes, we do have the comment was, Honourable Ryder asked if there's a funding model. Yes, there is a funding model. And then a minute later, there was a contradiction which said, we don't have any preconceived ideas about how the funding model is going to work. Okay? And the point, Chairperson, is that there hasn't been a funding model announced in Gauteng. No one knows what's going to happen with the funding of ETOLs, where Gauteng is going to find all this additional money that they need to repay. And as I listened to myself asking questions, to Mr. Molotsane's question, to your questions, Chair, I realized that it's probably unfair to be posing some of these questions directly to Treasury because they're quite political in nature. And so we also find ourselves with this last one that Dr. Modise has answered as best she can. But there's a political angle to these things as well. And really, Chair, I do think that when it comes to meetings of this nature, where we are discussing appropriations at this level, there really should be a member of the executive, be it the minister or the deputy minister, to assist their team of specialists with some of the more political questions. Because when we're talking about, and I mean, Mr. Njadu's question as well about the criteria for the SRD grant. It's a massively important question, but it's a political question. So it's really not a Treasury question. And so I think, Chair, I mean, we've had this discussion before. I've been shouted at for demanding that the minister should be at all of our meetings. I accept they shouldn't be at all of our meetings. But I do think when we're discussing something like this, where there's either the E&E or the adjustment E&E being discussed, I think it's incumbent on the executive to come in and protect their officials who should not be moving into the political space. So I'm feeling unfulfilled by some of the answers, Chair, but I do understand why. And I'd like there to be an invitation put to the minister to attend this meeting, certainly going forward, certainly following the February budget. I think it should be the minister that comes here, or his deputy, that comes and addresses these matters to us. Thank you,
Honourable Ryder. Honourable Njadi, do you want to come in? I saw you opened your video.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think one have to welcome the responses from National Treasury and also be grateful and appreciating the manner the questions was responded to. I think
so
the...
you are satisfied with the responses?
I'm satisfied, Chair, but because the only thing that I want to say here, Chair, is that I can make an example. The question on the social relief grant in terms of underspending, which National Treasury was very much, it's a technical question as well, in terms of the response to if one say underspending, I think Dr. Mampo was correcting the terminology on underspending, so that one is from a political view, not to see that money is not spent, but to see that the criteria used to make sure that funds are reaching the beneficiaries. So that's how I've seen the response. So from my side, Chair, I think I'm comfortable in terms of also the SOEs. And I think that I'm comfortable, Chair, to and really appreciating how the questions was responded to.
Okay.
So in that sense, thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Njatu. I think Honourable Members, to a certain extent, I find myself 50% agreeing with the Honourable Ryder, but 50% not. To say, I think expecting or inviting both the political heads to our meetings together with their technocrats, the administration, it's only helping. And what you're saying, Honourable Ryder, what if we can compare with what is happening or what has been happening or was happening in provinces in the legislature? If my department is called by a portfolio committee and I'm not there, they might as well send them back. But we don't want to get to that. I want to agree with you and take your concern to be genuine enough that some of the things need to be answered by the political heads, particularly on the issue of the e-toll, because a political decision needs to be taken first at the executive. At a cabinet level, before it can go to the administrator. The administrators are there to implement the decisions of the political head or the political structures. So we have not been unfair. We have, I think, raised relevant questions, but some of the questions, the some say 50-50. I'm agreeing and not agreeing to a certain extent that we will make sure that we pass the message. I think this has been a concern from your good self, at least after having raised it in a other forum. The deputy minister was able to attend some meetings and the former minister. But we will raise with the, I think they're not, the minister is not that rigid. We will raise it with him. And I think also, Dr. Mampo, you need to raise it as well with the ministry, that the committee is concerned that they seem not to be available all the time, or we will like at some stage to come and get answers from them as leaders, political leaders of those institutions, to have engagement with us. But overall, having said that, there were times where as a committee members were raising concerns that we are making such good recommendations to the House, and these recommendations are being adopted. But what is happening in terms of the implementation? Are they considered? Recommendations coming from our committee, Appropriations Committee, are they considered by the executive and the accounting officer for implementation? And having listened to the presentations today, I think we can boldly say our recommendations are being considered. Hence, we also, you know, have came up with a tracking mechanism, developed a tracking mechanism to follow up on our recommendations. But I think on behalf of the committee, Mampo and the team treasurer, we can say that we are happy that you seem to be listening to our recommendations, though, which are resolutions of the House, because those recommendations we recommend to the House and the House resolve on them. So keep on doing that and implement those resolutions that the House has taken. If there's no one who wants to have a bite, it's a bit late. I think we have come to the last item of the day. Nelly Babalo? I can't see other hands.
That's correct, Chairperson. Just a reminder.
Okay, tomorrow's meeting, I think members, we have also seen that in our WhatsApp group, that we will be having a joint meeting tomorrow at 9. I know we have agreed that our meetings will start at 10, but because it's Friday and some of the members have to travel to different areas and do their constituency work, we'll start at 9. So it's a joint meeting between the select committee and standing committee on appropriations. It's a public hearing meeting. Thank you very much. And the link and all the documents are on the group. Thank you very much, honorable members. Be safe. And team treasurer, thank you.